people opposing racism, but people building power strategically. And there's no way that the textile industry is not implicated in this. But we still think that North Carolina has moved. It is not the worst state in the South. It has always tended to be somewhere in the middle, in the sense that it was the last out of the Union and close to the first back in the Union in the Civil War. So it always has had that kind of
Reverend Nelson, we have to wrap up the show, but I wanted to just say one thing. In the clip we played, the Klansman or Nazi used the N-word, and we asked you, should we repeat that? You said yes. We have 10 seconds. Why?
Because the truth matters, Amy.
It's as simple as that. People need to know the truth of our history. And that word, which is very derogatory, is part of that history. And it is that simple.
We want to thank you both for being with us, Reverend Nelson Johnson and Joyce Johnson, survivors of the 1979 Greensboro Massacre, co-founders of the Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and now co-executive directors of the beloved Community Center of Greensboro, North Carolina. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices for Justice and Radical Healing. From Tuesday, October 6th through October 15th, streaming online. Voices for Justice and Radical Healing is an online speaker series in support of Living Yoga's trauma-informed services. Speakers will explore ways to create healing for individuals, systems, and culture through body-based practices. Again, that's Voices for Justice and Radical Healing from Tuesday, October 6th through October 15th, streaming online. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8:01 on Wednesday. It's time for Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Rowland. Stay tuned.
Hold your head up, lift the top of your mind, put your eyes on the earth, lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? Are you here to improve or damn it? Look right now, and you will see we're only here by the skin of our teeth as it is. So take heart and take care of your late with life.
And good morning, everyone. This is Paul Rowland speaking at you from my home in Portland, Oregon. Thank you, Buffy St. Marie, once again. I wonder if she's going to come out with some new recording. Always good to hear her voice in any case. So KABU is actually slowly starting to open up, I understand. Starting with this strip, I am dependent on my home computer, to get some of the articles I'm going to be referencing this morning. So I'm still doing it here, but maybe next week I'll be looking forward to coming at you live from the KBOO studios. So as you know, we're in our second month of our extended socially distance membership drive for this year. We are taking it slow, not breaking in every 10, 15 minutes with our membership pitches from Pledge Central. We're doing it differently, but we're still in need of your support. We thrive, we survive, we depend upon your membership contributions. So if you haven't done it, we encourage you to go to kboo.fm, and right there when you go to kboo.fm, it directs you, if you want, to all the information you need about how to donate. We have our regular membership. We're also thankful to those who can afford it to give us a regular monthly donation of whatever amount you're able. This is listener-sponsored radio, community radio, independent radio, a strong voice coming out of Portland for going on 52 years, and boy, do we need it now more than ever. So you can go to kbo.fm/give/donate, or just go to the website. Also through the KBOO mobile app and via the good old post office at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please send us your check. So as a listener and member-supported station, we depend upon your financial support. But, of course, that's not the only way you can help us out. As I've said repeatedly over the weeks during this extended membership drive, we're looking to get to spread the word about KBOO through social media, through email, through talking on the phone, through meeting up in person, wearing a mask and socially distance, of course, and let people know about this precious community resource, this vital community resource, and share the programs that you like on social media. Every one of them becomes a podcast upon completion on the website. Just go and click on audio, or in the search box, type in the name of the show, and you can find it and spread the word. All right. So, I don't know how many of you heard Democracy Now!, and once again, Mary Trump, a very lucid voice, a very lucid inside voice, who perhaps better than anyone can get into the dangerous territory of the mind of Donald Trump. And so I'm going to be talking about that, and also entertaining whatever else you're interested in talking about. Obviously, that's sort of dominating the news because I guess that's the way he wants it. So maybe we should just ignore him, but heck, you can't. The guy's tweeting and everywhere. And I think I mentioned early on in the Trump presidency that my one hope, I guess you could call it, one of my more optimistic views of a Trump presidency was that perhaps him being who he is and sort of leading the Republican Party down a perverted, even more perverted path, and as Mary Trump said, being enabled by them to carry out his grandiose perverse schemes, had the risk of imploding and basically carrying off the Republican Party, carrying off the most diseased aspects of vicious neoliberal capitalism. And who would have expected a coronavirus pandemic to hit right during the final year of his presidency, and then to hit him himself? It all seems like a kind of a reality TV script, although I guess they're not scripted, but it's very strange, isn't it? Anyway, so I titled my show A Tale of Two Viruses, The Triumph or the Triumph of the Ill, and I thank my old friend Patrick Mazza for that great pun. Because, so as Mary Trump emphasized the idea, and this talked up a lot of people have mentioned it on this show and other shows about Trump being mentally ill. Now, this is the first Wednesday of the month, which for many months I had devoted to issues of mental illness or so-called mental illness, mental liberation. So it's, I guess, appropriate that we're talking about this now, but I want to talk about ideological disease, the idea that the two viruses I mentioned are a kind of a mental virus that has deep, deep roots in Western culture. And now that virus, which I'll be trying to outline a little bit, has combined in Trump with this coronavirus, creating a very deadly cocktail that seems to be amping up his already manic tendencies and tendencies of grandiosity, narcissism, etc. But the virus, the mental virus, is as deadly, or I guess deadlier, if you look at the arc of Western culture, than the pandemic, but the two of them together are particularly deadly. So to take off on the theme of A Tale of Two Viruses, obviously from A Tale of Two Cities by Dickens, for Donald Trump, it's the best of times and the worst of times. Hell, he's president of the United States, the most powerful man in the world. He succeeded in keeping his creditors at bay. He laughed off impeachment, shrugged it off. He's imposed his will to dismantle and redirect most of the federal agencies and many of the policies at his command. He stonewalled revealing his tax returns. In some ways, he seems to be still riding high, but there's a certain desperate quality, if it's to be credited, the idea that one of the reasons he sought the presidency was to basically sort of rebrand himself to stave off bankruptcy, to stave off the reality that his tax returns and his debts reveal. So, again, who would have thought that this coronavirus, this natural phenomenon, seemingly, would come upon the scene and threaten his very unstable reality, and threaten the idea that he would get a second term and ride this whole thing out, and who knows what his ultimate exit strategy was, to seek exile, to be hosted ultimately by in Putin's Russia. Who knows what, did he even have a plan? That's the question. So, okay, 503-231-8187. What is this mental virus? I've done a bunch of reading, and I've been thinking about this for a long time. There's a intersectionality of virulent individualism, patriarchy or male supremacy, racialism or white supremacy, dysfunctional family dynamics, capitalist ideology, the ideology of the mind over the body, the human illusion of control over the environment. And all these, I would say, have a common origin, which is something that we don't get a chance to really look at or talk about too much. I think it goes back to the transition, the long arc of human history, and the ultimate disintegration of kinship, strong, small group bonds, and the origins of the male ego and its manifestation in the early temple building, hierarchically organized, male dominated societies, which superseded earlier forms, and the development of a kind of imperialistic, expansionist human culture, which basically set the stage for where we are now, and set in motion all these intersecting dynamics that I talked about. The rule by elites, the manipulations of ideological constructions of reality, which now take the form of what we call fake news, the idea that you can manipulate reality any way you want. So I had on my show, I think a couple years ago now, Chris Lehman from Boffler, who wrote a book called The Money Cult. And he wrote an article, when was it? Actually, a few years ago now, in The Nation, called Mr. Brightside, which he doesn't credit her, but does go back to Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Bright Sided, talking about this power of positive thinking, the idea that we can sort of make reality what we want by our positive thoughts. So I'm going to read a little bit from this, where he talks about Norman Vincent Peale. Which I've lost temporarily. Here we go. There's Trump's resistance to the tarnished nomenclature of failure, his fear of being publicly perceived as an also-ran or a bankrupt loser, is more than just solicitude for his public image. It's also the faith he was raised in, the positive thinking creed pioneered by Norman Vincent Peale, pastor of the Marble Collegiate Church in Manhattan, where the Trump family worshipped. Touting his religious credentials in his book Crippled America and How to Make America Great Again, Trump writes, Reverend Peale was the type of minister that I liked, and I liked him personally as well. I especially loved his sermons. He would instill a very positive feeling about God that also made me feel positive about myself. I would literally leave that church feeling like I could listen to another three sermons. There's no particular reason to doubt that Trump's endorsement of Peale's gospel is heartfelt, which is decidedly not the case with the candidate's clumsier efforts to package himself as a stout evangelical. Overtures that found him botching the names of Bible books and gamely suggesting that he's never done anything worth repenting. Peale presided over Trump's first wedding to the former Ivana Zelnikova in 1977, and many features of Trump's message that traditional political observers find so exasperating and resistant to critical inquiry can be traced to the Reverend's influence. In fact, Trump's sprawling record of policy reversals and flat-out lies isn't just a personality quirk, but the logical extension of the Reverend's gospel of positive thinking. Trump's new millennial gloss on Peale plies a vision of capitalist uplift steeped in the doggedly counter-empirical belief that Christians can achieve success by relentlessly intoning their own preferred image of prosperity. In parentheses, that's known as the prosperity gospel, which has taken such a strong hold and has a lot of ties to the certain aspects of what we call New Age thinking. Like his positive thinking spiritual master, Trump clearly believes that the manic repetition of what he desires to be real in both the pecuniary and political realms is enough to make it a reality. This is the guiding directive in Trump's preferred narrative of his otherwise far from self-evident personal success, and is just as powerful a driving force in his assured prophecy of an America that he will make great again. This set of auto-suggestive word pictures likewise forms the heart and soul of Peel's enormously influential preachments of personal success. A self-described missionary to American business, Peel burst into the pantheon of Protestant uplift with the 1952 publication of The Power of Positive Thinking, written in a curious mixture of psychoanalytic jargon and the imperative style of industrial age assembly manuals. The book laid out the basis for successful self-reinvention in the trenches of market warfare. Picturize, prayerize, and actualize was the mantra of the Peel method, and one of his key homilies drove home the process-driven character of his positive thinking gospel. Quote, on a roadside billboard, I saw an advertisement of a certain brand of motor oil, Peel announced to his success-hungry flock. The slogan read, a clean engine always delivers power. So will a mind free of negatives produce positives. That is to say, a clean mind will deliver power. Therefore, flush out your thoughts. Give yourself a clean mental engine, remembering that a clean mind, even as a clean engine, always delivers power. Like Peel, Trump believes that the manic repetition of what he desires to be real is enough to make it a reality. And this goes on. It's a pretty long article. I've referenced it on my program page, Wednesday Talk Radio at KBOO.FM. I think it's a really important piece, and there's many others. Trump battles the coronavirus with the power of positive thinking from the Washington Examiner of March of this year. Of course, there's a look up Brightsided When Happiness Doesn't Help by Barbara Ehrenreich. Donald Trump's twisted interpretation of the power of positive thinking is killing Americans, from Religion News Service of just of October 7th of this year, and a number of others, some of which I've referenced on my program page of Wednesday Talk Radio. So I've kind of given a somewhat scattershot, but my attempt at a delineation of what this virus of the mind, and we can see it really plays out in how his mind, you can see the struggle within his mind to overcome the virus by the power of positive thinking. I really think that's what's going on. I think it's a really important angle to look at this. So it looks like we already have a caller. Steve is on the line. Welcome to the show, Steve. Good morning.
I would wonder why the futility of negative thinking would be a counterpoint to that, and you know, having worked at Greenpeace and within so many you know, immersed myself in liberal left thinking, I feel like you know, it's so debilitating to look at the news and then just see some, you know, the trouble that everything is so disparate, and you know, one of the things Trump said during his inauguration, and the only thing he said that resonated with me, was for every problem there's a solution. You know, having worked with people who are problem solvers and you know, entrepreneurs and environmental entrepreneurs and doing good work, you know, that attitude of can-doism.
We're going to have to cut you off there. Sorry, you can't. There's certain words you can't say on the air. So thank you, Steve. That was actually not Peel, The Road Less Traveled. I think I've got it right here in front of me. I can't remember the author of that book. The 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Okay, so I want to just take off on one thing. And it's not negative thinking to actually do the hard work of understanding what the problem is. And I think I've attempted to delineate some aspects of the problem, which is fundamentally a historical problem. It has to do with the origins of this particular culture. I think American culture is the most virulent form of viral Western dominator culture, and Trump is kind of the most virulent exemplar of that particular culture. The can-do attitude was also the attitude that led the Puritans to come across the sea and to impose their will. So, you can do a lot, but what is it you're actually doing? And do you actually understand the roots of why you're doing what you're doing? I think we're propelled forward mostly a lot by an unconscious dynamics, which I call a virus. You can call conditioning. You can call lots of things. But, I think Freud was very helpful in his way. Feminists have been very understanding, helpful in various ways. There's a lot of people who've contributed, but we haven't really put it all together, I believe. So, let's talk about what is the real problem. And, I think the false binary of negative and positive is binary thinking itself is one of the fundamental problems. Instead of being immersed in a world that's more fluid and where, people aren't imposing their will, males aren't imposing their wills on females, white people aren't imposing their wills of people of color, et cetera, et cetera. But I'd like to hear what your thoughts are. I know this is kind of a deep dive. I've been wanting to do shows like this. I've kind of flitted around the edges. I haven't really presented my own historical view, which I could get more deeply into if you want to have a dialogue on that. I think it's very, very important. What are the origins of patriarchy? What are the origins of human domination over nature? What are the origins of this particular culture that, again, I think has reached its most diseased or virulent form right now in some ways? We're kind of in the end game. 503-231-8187, we've got John on the line. Hello, John.
Good morning. I didn't catch what the last caller was saying about Scott Peck. It's Scott Peck's book.
That's right. That's right.
He wrote a really interesting. I'll change the subject for just a brief second. He wrote a really interesting book called "People of the Lie" about the narcissistic clients that he dealt with over the years in his psychiatric practice, and it was one of the most interesting books I ever read. Really stuck with me, and then when Trump came into office, it really resonated. I don't have the book anymore. I wish I did, but we don't have time to go into that right at the moment. But
certainly apropos of the current moment.
Yeah, people of the lie. I'll just say one thing about what he said in that book. He said that when people get too far into narcissism, they're unreformable in his experience. And so that would be Donald Trump, wouldn't it?
I guess so. Yeah, I hear people say, oh, well, maybe he'll be humbled by the experience. But I think I thought it was a really great insight that, if indeed he does, his body is able to overcome this, along with, of course, the highest high-tech and most expertise in terms of medical care that you can get, he'll be even more unreformable. So it's a very, very a dangerous situation. I think, saying that the coronavirus is going to cure him is, I doubt that. But anyway, yeah, that's a really good point.
I was skeptical of the whole thing until I saw the way he was breathing, because the way the doctors were, or at least his White House doctor was acting, it just made me feel like everybody was making it all up, and all these other people were getting sick, supposedly, you never know with Trump anymore. Oh, and I'll touch on, remember what Jesus said when Pilate was questioning him? He said, "What is truth?" You know. So humans have had this problem with lying and exaggerating for as long as we've been around, apparently.
But it's been exacerbated by imbalanced power relationships, where you had, this is a really key point that I know is somewhat controversial and might be outside of most people's thinking, but there were checks and balances within small group kinship-based societies, which put a brake on narcissistic tendencies and tendencies to lie, because you had to live with that group 24 hours a day constantly, and lying tended to disrupt things that disrupted the ability of the group to survive and thrive were held in check. And there's a lot of really great literature, anthropological and other literature, on how these sophisticated mechanisms were in play. And with the power dynamics, the ability to impose your view on other people, that's where the real problem comes in.
Well, do you think a large population of a society or civilization, whatever word you want to use, could correct itself? I mean, to me, it seems like only small groups of people could really keep it together, you might say.
Well, I think that's a really important discussion. A lot of people take it as saying, you want to go back to the Stone Age, you want to kill off, whatever. And that's the point. That's not the point. The point is, what are the mechanisms that can be reinstituted? I think Paul Shepard has a really interesting take on this. In that you have to, the idea is not to go back in time, not to forcibly, as in some ways the Pol Pot regime tried to do, which is not a laughing matter. The point is how can we recreate some of those small group dynamics within existing mass society? And there's there's a lot of Tocqueville talked about, these tendencies of Americans to form these voluntaristic groups. I think there's always a tendency to form, even the tendency towards joining cults, I think, is a tendency in that direction. We're always scrambling to try to form some kind of what's the word I'm searching for? Some kind of context within which we are not these sort of anonymous mass beings. And, we have our social networks. We have, even social media is sort of a desperate attempt to technologically solve the problem, which I don't think it can do. But, yeah, I mean, as to the question of whether it's possible, we can be optimistic or pessimistic, but I think to focus on what are the things that we can do within our lives, I think anarchists have always had really interesting approach towards voluntaristic mutual aid. I think the a lot of the responses to the coronavirus, to disasters, to spontaneously form these networks of mutual aid, I think meetup groups on Facebook, these are all attempts to do that. I mean, I would not even attempt to say what's possible or what's not possible in order to stave off total disaster.
I think, unfortunately, education has failed to help us cope with all these new technologies in light of the technologies are always given over to the money, to power, or capitalism, instead of protected and allowed to be used with education to edify the people and help them move forward. Money always corrupts new technologies and human tendencies to make up crap. Well, good talking to you.
Okay, well, thank you, John. It's been interesting talking with you, and I look forward to talking with some other folks, 503-231-8187. I know this is a time, a very trying time for all of us. I'm not sure how useful people feel it is to take these sort of deep philosophical excursions. I think maybe it's the time is now to actually come together and really understand, you know, what I think Freud did for understanding that there's these powerful unconscious drives that take us in directions that we may not consciously want to go. Marx's great contribution to see that there's these basic mechanisms of power and economy that basically form the sort of the air we breathe, the water we swim in, that we're not even aware of because we're so always reacting to and having to adapt to what the elite power structure has set in motion for us, and to the demands of the, you know, this money economy, the wage slave economy that was imposed upon us all. Anyway, 503-231-8187, if we want to talk about something more direct, more practical, I'm open to that too. Obviously, Trumpism is a phenomenon that we're forced to reckon with, and I think it's a window into understanding a lot of these deeper dynamics. So we are in our membership drive, as I said before. Please help us out to the extent that you're able. And of course, we all know how disastrous this economic situation is. But there are people who, for one reason or another, have been able to stay the course economically, financially. And especially you, we're looking to you to support us. We're looking to people to chip in whatever they can at KBOO.FM. We've got till October 31st. We've got an $80,000 goal. I'm not actually sure exactly where we are on that, but we need to raise whatever we can to keep this station going, thriving, and no matter what happens, if there's going to be some who knows what scenario is going to play out with the election, it does seem to be shifting somewhat with this implosion. I think it's, I don't know, over 30 people now in the Trump circle have contracted the coronavirus. It's, and yet they're staying the course. They're not even revealing the names of people anymore. They're basically, this shows the great power that the ideological virus has, that they're not willing to concede one inch. I remember the book Sometimes a Great Notion by a great Ken Kesey. Never Give an Inch was I think Henry Stamper's his slogan. That seems to be so. Henry Stamper and Donald Trump are stamped from the same coin. There's many, many figures in U.S. history. You know, to see Trump as an aberration only, I think, is a faulty way to look at him. Sure, he's a particularly virulent, aberrant form of this already virulent, aberrant psychocultural matrix that we live in, but he's far from the only one. Sort of the American exceptionalism itself, you know, the founding of the United States, you know, in some ways the Puritans sort of exemplified that virulent ideology. But I really don't want to hear myself talk. I've got some other things I could read from, but I'd really love to hear what you got to say, and we only have, boy, about 20 minutes left. So give me a call. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO, 503-231-8187. I picked up on Wikipedia this virus is the mind, if you really want to go with this deeper into this. It was an essay by British evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, first published in the book Dennett and His Critics Demystifying the Mind. He originally wrote the essay in 1991 and delivered it anyway. The essay discusses how religion can be viewed as a meme, an idea previously expressed by Dawkins in The Selfish Gene. He analyzes the propagation of religious ideas and behaviors as a mimetic virus, analogous to how biological and computer viruses spread. The essay was later published in The Devil's Chaplain, blah, blah, blah. Dawkins defines the symptoms of being infected by the virus of religion, and by, you know, religion, again, you know, capitalism is a religion. There's also a book, The Arrogance of Humanism, which is a somewhat controversial and very difficult subject to get into, but humanism, as David Ehrenfeld defines it, is a religion. These, you know, capitalism exists only on the belief that, you know, it exists, that it's going to continue. It's a faith, as it were. The power of positive thinking is a religion. Anyway, Dawkins defines the symptoms of being infected by the virus of religion, providing examples for most of them, and tries to define a connection between the elements of religion and its survival value. Dawkins also describes religious beliefs as mind parasites and as gangs that will come to constitute a package which may be sufficiently stable to deserve a collective name such as Roman Catholicism or component parts to a single virus. He suggests that religious belief is in the faith sufferer typically shows the following elements. It is impelled by some deep inner conviction that something is true or right or virtuous, a conviction that doesn't seem to owe anything to evidence or reason, but which nevertheless the believer feels is totally compelling and convincing. The believer typically makes a positive virtue of faith being strong and unshakable, despite it not being based upon evidence. There's a conviction that mystery per se is a good thing, the belief that it is not a virtue to solve mysteries but enjoy them. Anyway, it goes on. This is a Wikipedia viruses of the mind. I would say that my view of religion is a little more nuanced. I think that religion is also an attempt to resolve contradictions or cognitive dissonances or historical situations, and to recreate again that need for powerful human bonds and connection, and unfortunately becomes detached from the original human bond connection, which is a kinship society based in close connections with the rest of the natural world. So yeah, that's one thing. 503-231-8187. Let's see. Let's go to this other article. Donald Trump's twisted interpretation of the power of positive thinking is killing Americans. On Wednesday, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention told a Senate subcommittee that while progress is being made on a coronavirus vaccine, it won't be available until the summer or fall of 2021 if one is to be found safe and effective and receives FDA approval soon. It's possible a very limited supply could be available to healthcare workers by the end of 2020. This is from September 18th. On Thursday morning, the White House directly contradicted the CDC by stating that it is aiming to have 100 million doses of vaccine available by the end of October. Again, this is Trump's power of positive thinking, not to mention a crass electoral ploy. So the president wants us to believe that roughly a third of our nation's population can be vaccinated with a currently non-existent vaccine before the November 3 election. It doesn't matter that his administration's own experts are saying this timeline is a pipe dream, and it doesn't matter that the pharmaceutical companies that have been transparent about their progress show no signs of having a vaccine ready that soon. And it goes on to outline where Moderna is at and some of the others. This is what responsible medical science looks like. It's not a process to rush. There are good reasons why vaccines take an average of 10 years to develop. For Trump, who spent the first part of this year telling us repeatedly that the virus would just disappear one day, probably when the weather warmed up in April, now finds himself in a real pickle. He's consistently behind the polls with an election just 7 weeks away. What's an embattled incumbent to do? Rely on Norman Vincent Peale and the power of positive thinking, that's what. According to the publisher's jacket copy, the book has sold more than 7 million copies worldwide since its release 1952. I'm not so naive as to imagine that Donald Trump has actually read one of those copies, since he is a notorious non-reader, but his father was enough of a Peel fan when Trump was growing up that he heard plenty of speeches. Anyway, I've mentioned this earlier. This is an article from Religion News Service, Donald Trump's Twisted Interpretation of the Power of Positive Thinking is Killing Americans, which, again, I've referenced on my KABU program page. And since I see I haven't enticed anyone to call up and engage me on these very interesting and I like to think profound thoughts, I'll just continue reading this. In the 1980s, I was a Peel fan too, since my dad, and this is Jana Reese writing this. Since my dad was a psychologist, we had a fair number of pop psychology books lying around the house, and I read The Power of Positive Thinking out of curiosity in the eighth grade. I wouldn't say it changed my life, but it did help me survive junior high, and that's not nothing. Peel's advice about conquering fear gave me courage to audition for a solo in the school musical, and then to sing it, Shaking Like a Leaf, in front of the entire student body. The book taught me the mantra that I could do all things through Christ who strengthened me. Looking at this now as a historian of American religion, I can see that The Power of Positive Thinking is a set piece of the 1950s, infused simultaneously with a relentless post-war optimism and a devotion to the wonders of science. The principles in the book, Peel reminds us again and again, are scientific. Again, that this harks to this scientific war where the climate science deniers declare that they're on the side of science as well as their opponents, the self-proclaimed climate realists, of which I am one, and on many other fronts, sort of because science has become the dominant ideology or paradigm of the day, everybody has to, you know, what's that version of creationism, intelligent design. Anyway, our scientific nod to the decade's glowing fascination with progress into the book's religious heritage and the New Thought movement, which is something that Chris Layman, who I quoted earlier from his article in The Nation, talks about in his book, The Money Cult. Anyway, the New Thought movement, which also gave birth to Christian Science, which is a whole subject of its own. There are many problematic aspects of Peel's book, including that it sometimes plants the seeds for reality avoidance. Quote, attitudes are more important than facts, Peel tells us, quoting the work of a prominent mid-century psychiatrist. A confident and optimistic thought pattern can modify or overcome the fact altogether. You can see how Donald Trump takes advice like this to its logical conclusion. If we just keep repeating over and over that the virus will disappear, it will. Facts don't matter nearly so much as wishful thinking. And I can continue with that. Again, looks like we do have a caller on the line. Harvey, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Paul. Well, I'd like to comment on religion.
Okay.
It turns out that almost virtually every indigenous groups of people have what is known as a sky god. And if you ask people, you know, where heaven is, they'll all point up. If you ask them where God lives, they'll all point up. And it seems that all religions have connections with sky gods, angels. In Christianity, it's angels. God, even Jesus, went back up, and chariots of fire. Everything has to do with the sky. And people who study ufology feel that this is a kind of a connection, that it's a misconception that there is a reason that the religion is so worldwide and connected with the skies, because that ancient societies and even modern day societies feel that these high-tech entities came down, and they were, of course, you know, they say that one person's technology is another person's magic, so they were, in a sense, they gave agriculture, all kinds of gifts to the people. And so there is a possibility that what we think of as the gods are actually advanced entities. And I myself am a very spiritual person. I believe in the spirit of life and the Gaia principle, the earth is alive. But as far as gods are concerned, it may be that one day when we get out into the sky and we're searching for other planets right now to live in, and then we'll come with our silver suits and we'll come down on the planet, and the indigenous people there will think of us as the sky gods.
Well, I take issue actually with your historical interpretation. I think that if you look at the earlier forms of human society were what a lot of people call animistic, and they actually believe strongly in the sort of Mother Earth as well as sky god. They're kind of I think conceived of perhaps as masculine and feminine tendencies. I think the ufology perspective there, you know, who knows, there might be something to that, but I think the idea that sky gods dominated all forms of human society is completely erroneous. I think the origins of the sky god as being the dominant actually came more with the transition from the Paleolithic to the Neolithic, and the imposition, sort of the reflection. I think it's more a earthly reflection of the patriarchal pyramidal domination, which then got reflected as in the cosmic sphere. That's my own interpretation. So we differ greatly on that. Are you still there?
Yes. Also, the word faith. You know, they call it people of faith and believers in faith, in the faith. But faith doesn't mean it's true. It just means you have faith that it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
Well, okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay, well, thank you. I guess he didn't want to actually respond to my criticism of his initial thesis, but looks like we got another caller. We'll just go directly to Kelly. We only have we're almost out of time, but you got plenty of time yourself. Go ahead. What do you got to say?
Quickly, I will say I appreciate you talking about this because I need more experience articulating it verbally. I like looking at that book about humanism, the falsehood, or what was it about humanism?
It's called The Arrogance of Humanism by David Ehrenfeld. It came out in the 70s. He basically, he says that his definition of humanism is this kind of hyper-rationalism, the idea that humans can solve all problems through the application of reason. I think, the problem with that is that this reason was a reason detached from the body, detached from nature, and the idea that we could manipulate and control nature, that men could manipulate and control women, et cetera. There's been lots of work similar, but I think this was kind of a seminal work in that field.
And this has been really important to hear you talk about this, even the last few minutes that I've heard you on this show, because I'm taking art history for the first time and political science since right before the pandemic started, and I'm in master's classes right now, and I never have taken these things because of I couldn't figure out what didn't sit right with me. And I feel that just because we say we need to get back to humanism or, you know, a faith, that isn't going to solve everything. That is a systemic problem in our, I guess, way of making money, sharing, you know, our energy with, I don't know, our employers. So I feel relief that you are giving me food for thought. And I will look at your page. You have a page, you said, about...
Oh, yeah. All programs have a page on the KBOO.FM website. KBOO.FM, and mine is called Wednesday Talk Radio. And you can look up all my past shows if you want. You can look at the links. I'm going to put that book and some others on other links on there as well after the show.
Mm-hmm. And one more thing is, we're in our political plans, election 2020, they wanted to talk about tactics people used for the debate and the presidential election. And I just want to say, I think it's beyond tactics at this point. It's like what we heard on Democracy Now! This morning, like you said, it's a confabulation that has to do with maybe age and just say one truthful thing and then, you know, lump everything in. And I liked, you know, you bringing that thread through to this show also. So thank you.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad it stimulated you to thought, which is what I'm always hopeful for, and I really appreciate if I get to engage with listeners who are interested in some of the same things.
Question, I guess, okay. would be, how do I address when someone says, hey, what's the debate tactic here? I mean, I feel like we're kind of all being held hostage and as citizens. I mean, we have
power to do something. I'm not sure I'm not sure. It's hard to say. You know, that's a complex question. His tactics seem to be to browbeat, basically.
Yes.
Browbeat,
thank
deflect,
you.
Deny. Yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate that because I feel like that would be more my answer to explore than some of the other things. People were trying to be open-minded without opinion. You know, like, I can say browbeat, and it's not, I don't know. It's just so crazy. So thank you. I will think about that focus. In my class.
All right. Well, thank you, Kelly. Good to hear you. We have only a few minutes left. I could read a little more, but I'd love to hear one more person, 503-231-8187. This has been an interesting discussion because it's something that's very close to me. I've spent many, many years reading innumerable books about the course of human history and what I call a cultural mutation, which, you know, has deep, deep roots. You know, I could talk about the male hunting cult, which developed tens of thousands of years ago, which seems to have led to the gender, original gender separation between males and females, and original the origins of the power dynamics, and kind of set the stage for the so-called Neolithic revolution. But what does this have to do with Trump and the election and the debates? Good question. My thesis is that in order to understand, as Kelly said, the systemic nature, we have to actually understand what the nature of the system or paradigm is. And I think we don't really understand it very much collectively on all sides. And so I do what I can to stimulate whatever thought I can and point people to some interesting readings. I don't know, sometimes I've kind of put off talking about this sort of thing because, you know, I like to have people who have something really cogent to say about what's happening right now in the present tense. And or my co-host Jacqueline Keeler, who gives a very, very powerful presentation of the origins of colonialism and how we still exist in a colonial situation and what that means, the relationship between Euro settler society and the original indigenous societies. Oh, looks like we do have another caller. John, you only have like a minute, two maybe. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Okay, Paul. It's good to hear you. So you were talking, I think, earlier about people dividing up into small groups or only being able to solve major problems of their own in smaller groups. Now, anyway, so those small groups, I have an analogy you can consider. Each of those small groups is very like the crew of a pirate ship, with ruled by consensus, but even though the captain maybe has the power of life and death, he still only is captain by consensus of the crew. And they treat each other well and democratically, but they prey upon, you know, the outside citizenry.
Well, that's I think historically that's not necessarily true. I think the people of this part of the world, the people of the Columbia River, had very, very, very complex, long-standing interrelationships. I mean, that dynamic doesn't.
That's not piracy. I don't see how I don't follow at all. I was talking about, you know, pirates at sea kind of thing.
No, well, I was talking about the real group.
Oh, how we pirated their things and had no compunction of it because they weren't us.
Well, that pirate ships, you know, that's a phenomenon based upon mercantile then capitalist society. It's not that's not a good analogy for what I call small kinship-based groups, which really have existed and still exist.
Oh, I see, it's an analogy for the, say, the Republicans. I mean, they're pirating us.
Sure.
And they don't care.
Okay, well, I see where you're going, but I was making a, I was saying that there's different forms, you know, there's elite, you know, dominating groups that do have that dynamic, secret societies, Skull and Bones.
I wasn't necessarily relating to your, this is more of a general thing you can apply and as an overlay and look at a group and say, are they acting as though they were pirates and they're loyal to themselves and dedicated and hardworking, but it's to the goal of, you know, the ruination of somebody else.
No, I totally agree with. I see what you're saying now. I'm making a counterpoint there, and that, in fact, that's the nature.
Yeah, we need to be a group that isn't.
Well, that's a long discussion, and we are flush out of time. But thank you so much, John, and thank you, Kelly, Harvey, other John, Steve, and the others. And this is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you to Sonia for operating the board. And keep listening to your community radio station and support us at KBO.FM. Thank you so much.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. We feature interviews with leaders in the community focusing on issues important to Washington County.
Today, our show was taped during the volatile